Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome back. Tonight's class, we will discuss the Maharal of Prague, the well-known Maharal of Prague, Rabbi Yehuda Lowy. Tonight's class, of course, our entire course is in memory of Dr. Mark Weinberg, Zichrono Livracha. And tonight's specific lecture is sponsored by Susan Adelaine Matarazzo, in memory of Elaine's beloved father, Isidore Matarazzo, Yisrael Ben David. We thank the Matarazzos for sponsoring and enjoy the treats in the back. Okay, tonight's course, the Maharal, is an oft-quoted commentary, a personal favorite of mine. If any of you have been at my Chumash Shiurim Wednesday Lunch and Learn or Shabbos morning, you will be familiar with the Maharal, as I am fond of quoting the parts, at least that I understand from him. He is a giant, very well placed. You could not have a course similar to the one that we have of great Jewish books or great Jewish personalities and not include the Maharal of Prague in such a course simply because of the impact that he had on the Jewish world. We'll speak about this a little bit at length in a moment, but just as a word of introduction, what Rashi did to the text of Chumash, in which Rashi took that which was there in front of everybody, but almost inaccessible, hard to grasp, and Rashi took your hand and showed you how to read Chumash, told you that Tanakh is accessible to everybody. In a way, the Maharal has done that with what we call Agadata, what he did with what we call the statements of the sages that are not based in Halacha, but based on explaining some of the stories, the parables, the riddles that we'll see that the sages are very fond of saying, and they were closed, they were sealed, they were hard to understand, and as Rashi explained the text, the Maharal is going to be the father of opening up Medrash, opening up Agadata, opening up the statements of the sages and showing their depth, their beauty, and making them as accessible as possible. Let's jump right in. What I'd like to do, we'll give a little biographical sketch of the times that he lived in and who he was. But most of the time tonight, what I'd like to do is share through his own words, to say that we're going to share his approach is larger than I could possibly even imagine doing, an example of his approach to how he addressed Medrash, how he addressed the statement of the sages, and we'll weave through a number of different statements, and hopefully through his own words, get a sense of what he shared with us and the Jewish world that he left us. So let's just begin with your notes, with a little bit of the biography. I assume you can still hear me, right? Okay, the Maharal was believed to have been born in Poland. We don't know exactly, in around the year 1512. You know, part of being a great person is that when you're born, you don't necessarily know that you're going to be a great person. So in the 1500s, records weren't as kept as meticulously as they are today. So there's some who felt he was born in 1512, as late as 1526. It's unclear exactly when he was born. Around the early 1500s, we know. It's believed that he was born in Poland, and he was born to a fairly established rabbinic and scholarly family, and seems to have established himself as quite a scholar at a very young age. The name Maharal, his real name, of course, was Rabbi Yehuda ben Bezalel Lowy, or Levuye, pronounced in a bunch of different ways depending on the language that it's being spoken in. Maharal comes from Morenu Harav Lowy. Morenu Harav Levuye, or Levi Lowy, however we want to exactly pronounce his last name. And that you see the letters highlighted, which is for the Maharal. It's a German word for lion, his last name, which was often used to refer to a Jew. The Jew was referred to as a lion. Yaakov Avinu blessed his son Yehuda as a Gur Aryeh, as a young lion cub. And that name, we'll see, became the name of his most famous sefer, his commentary on Rashi. He titled the Gur Aryeh, which is also a play on his last name. We know that he was the Rav in Moravia and Nikolsburg. The years vary. Some say 35 years, a little bit less. I've heard, if you look it up, you'll find we just don't have the records in a clear way. But clearly, from the mid-1550s till about the year 1588, some say early, some say later, he was a Rav and then retired to Prague. Very interesting, he retired to Prague. He left the rabbinate, thought he was done, but he was a giant. And he ends up in Prague, and shortly thereafter, or again, debatable exactly how long after, he becomes the Rav in Prague. He spends most of his life outside of Prague. That's clear, despite the fact that he's known as the Maharal of Prague, because he was there during some prominent years, and he was a very prominent figure when he was there. But after spending a number of years as the Rav in Prague, he leaves as he becomes the chief rabbi of all of Poland, which he then does that for a number of years, and then returns back to Prague, where he dies and is buried in the old Jewish cemetery in the year 1609. Regardless of exactly when he was born, he lived a very long life, potentially as old as 97. Some of the other estimates would put him in his early 80s and anywhere in between. For that day and age, was a very significant, long life that he lived. We know a little bit about his wife, Pearl. There was a tradition that she was quite a scholar as well. He had six daughters and a son. And it's also believed that he had a family tradition to have been descended from David HaMelech, as did, first class, Rashi. Rashi also had such a similar, there's such a Masorah that he was descended as well. The Maharal was a forceful personality. There is a statue of him in the city of Prague today, in the city hall. There are not so many Jews who have statues of them in Europe. You could probably count them on your finger, probably. I don't know for sure. Maybe there's another one somewhere. But that's the towering figure that he was in the Jewish world, in the non-Jewish world, for his scholarship. He was a mystic. He was a philosopher. He was well versed in science and mathematics. He was he was that kind of person, and he was a forceful person. He was a Rav of a shul. We have records of his sermons that he gave in which he blasts his community on certain behaviors, talking in shul, for example, which I could tell you from experience, you have to be a real strong personality to do that. And we have no evidence whether or not he was successful or not in that. This is a long-standing problem in the Jewish people, but we know he has an entire sermon dedicated. There was a thing going on in those days of ruining shidduchim for families, whispering about yichus. It was a problem. Communities and ages had issues and problems, and he would stand at the pulpit and rail against certain behaviors that he saw were inappropriate. We're going to see how much he valued the statement of the sages in a moment. We'll see that. So the sages have a formula for education. At five, the Mishnah Pirkei Avos. In 5 years old, you're supposed to start learning Chumash, and at 10 years old, you're supposed to start learning Mishnah, and at 15 years old, you're supposed to start learning Gemara. Now, today, that's not done, nor was that done in the days of the Maharal. We start learning Gemara in many schools, certainly in the New York area, fifth grade. Some even want to push it. You know, there's this constant pushing earlier. 15 years old. 15, the Mishnah says, the sages themselves say, don't start studying our words until a child is 15. You have to be old enough to understand what you're doing. And we start them way earlier. So the Maharal went to Prague and saw what was going on, and he started his own school system. It was a school system based on the words of the sages. We're going to learn Chumash at 5 and Mishnah at 10 and Gemara at 15 because that's what the sages say to do. Who are we to do it any different and think it's going to be successful? So this is a person who comes into town and is ready to take on and ready to change and ready to take action. He was a forceful personality. We will learn a number of legends. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the most famous legend surrounding the Maharal, which of course is the Golem. Of course, we'll talk about the very end in case you want to leave before I tell you the truth about that legend. Okay. Now, what we're out of all the things that he was, and as a scholar and as a Kabbalist, a Talmudist, he was beyond words as far as his intellect. He was unprecedented in his impact on Jewish study, and as I mentioned, in terms of like what Rashi did to the text of Tanakh. Maharal does for Agadata, for Medrash, which is the perplexing and enigmatic statements of the sages, which are found primarily in the Midrash, and yet sprinkled also throughout the Talmud. (Clears throat) Let's take a moment to explain what Agadotah and Medrash is. Most of the Talmud, most of the Gemara, 2,711 pages, the overwhelming majority, if I had to choose a number, 90% of it or so, 85 to 90%, I'm just making up that number, is halachic in nature, meaning it's a discussion of the sages about halacha. Here's a verse that describes tzitzis. Here's a verse that describes tefillin, Shabbos. How do we keep it? What do we do? What's the law? What about like this? What if this happens? What if, and from the back and forth of the Talmud, and the end result is, this is how we act. This is how we behave. This is how we fulfill the mitzvah. That is the overwhelming majority of the Talmud. There is certain passages, long, lengthy passages, and then sprinkling of statements. And then we have the Midrash, which are statements that have nothing to do with Jewish law. We would put it in the category of maybe Jewish philosophy, describing some of the biblical stories that we're familiar with, filling in some details, expounding on details. Some of them are just riddles that we find in the words of the sages. And they're very difficult statements to fully understand or grasp what they mean. And they sometimes seem almost impossible or incomprehensible. Then there are many statements like that. I brought you a number in the first box just to give an example from the beginning of Chumash. A few, Rashi quotes all of these. So I'm not even pulling them from sources that you've never even heard. These are found in Rashi. For example, Rashi comments, the earth was commanded, this is on the phrase of the pasuk that says, Eitz Osev, Eitz Peri Limino, which literally would translate, when Hashem describes the creation of the world, an Eitz Pri, a tree that is a fruit. That would be the literal translation. And Rashi comments that the earth was commanded to bring forth trees that tasted itself the same as the fruit. That the command was that the apple tree should grow out of the earth, and that if you took a piece of bark, the tree would taste like the apple. That's what Hashem wanted. But it did not do so. But the earth did not, this is Rashi. The earth, quoting a Medrash, the earth did not do as it was commanded so that the tree would taste like the fruit. And instead, it produced trees that produced fruits, but were not fruit themselves. Therefore, when man was later punished for his sin, which we're familiar with the sin of Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, when man was punished, what was cursed because of man? The earth was cursed. Says Rashi, there's a reason why the earth was cursed, that it should be cursed for its sin, together with man being cursed for his sin. This is a Rashi in Chumash. And if I were to ask a child or an adult, so what do you think it means that the earth was commanded to bring forth a tree and it didn't and it failed? What does that mean? I don't know. What does that mean? That's a very difficult statement to say that the earth was commanded to do something and didn't and then it was punished. Rashi similarly quotes when the sun and the earth and the moon and all everything was created. So the two luminaries, Ha-Me'oros, Ha-Gedolos, Hagdolim, the two great luminaries, the sun and the moon. And the Torah seems to equate them, that they were both great or large. And Rashi quotes that the sun and the moon were actually created equal in size. But the moon was diminished after it complained when it said, how can it be, the moon complains to Hashem, two kings are going to use the same crown? That I should be the same size during the night as the sun should be during the day? So Hashem says, you're right. Go diminish yourself. And that's why we have a sun that's very large and a moon that's far smaller. So says Rashi in quoting the Medrash. What do you think? Would a scientist agree with such an explanation as to why the sun and the moon are different? No, for sure not. What are the sages saying? What does it mean that the moon complained and said, I should be the same as the sun? And Hashem says, oh yeah, so make yourself small. That's the one more. Noach, this one you're probably more familiar with, this is quoted often, also found in Rashi. Noach emerged wounded from the ark. Each one of these, by the way, is always based on a word or a phrase in the Chumash itself, which seems either out of place or extraneous. And the sages pick up and say, Noach emerged wounded from the ark. Why? Because one time he tarried, or literally was lazy in feeding the lion, and it bit him. So we have statements like this, all three of these statements, that either defy logic, or our understanding, or science, and they're perplexing. And these are Rashi and Chumash. Again, I didn't even go to the Medrash to express things which are way beyond. These are familiar, but they're very difficult. And Agadata is the study of this body of work of the sages that deal with such types of that are not halachic in nature. They expound on the text, stories, philosophy, but the words of the sages are couched in riddles or exaggerations, difficult to explain. The Maharal lived in an interesting time. On the one hand, he lived in what could be described as a little bit of a golden age of Prague. In this one city of Prague for a 50-60 year period was a tremendous amount of Talmidei Chachamim, even though the Jewish community was never tremendously large, but there was a tremendous amount of Talmidei Chachamim in the same way that he's living in the same era as the golden age, so to speak, of Tzfat that we spoke about last week. He literally, if you remember the Ramak, Rav Moshe Cordovero, and the Ari himself, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, they both died in 1570 and 1572. They're living literally in the same time period, just in different parts of the world. The Prague is a center of scholarship, and Tzfat is the center of Kabbalistic thought. But he's also living during the Renaissance period in Europe at the time. And the Renaissance period, like always, the Jews are always influenced and affected by the surrounding winds that are in the world around them. And the Renaissance period, amongst other things, created this questioning of the words of the sages to say, well, that doesn't make sense. That doesn't fit our understanding of science. That doesn't make sense to a rational mind. And in that era, the Maharal is going to become the fiercest of defenders of the statements of the sages to say, only a fool would take these words at face value. One has to understand that the sages, the depth of their words is not to be read simply and taken at face value. There's more there. I want to read you his words. I want to read you his words as he describes. It's on the bottom of your, I think I have a different version. It's probably on the top of the second page, actually, in the first box there. Maharal writes as follows in the box. But one who says, see where I am? One who says that Agado are not words of Torah like all the rest of Torah, which were transmitted from Sinai. If anyone were to claim, says the Maharal, that the words of Agadata, some of the words that I read to you about the earth being commanded to bring forth fruits, or a lion biting Noah on the Tevah, the sun and the moon, someone were to say, those words are not from Sinai. Those words were made up by the sages. They just came up with it, stories, fanciful tales. It's not Torah Misinai. Has no portion in the world to come. Says the Maharal, you are outside the realm of traditional Jewish thought. For one who understands their words will see that they are indeed divine wisdom. Chachmat Elokit. One who has no wisdom will only see the physical words before them. Yeah, if you read the word literally, you say the moon complained to the sun, you'll say that's Narishkeit. So if you take it at that value, so then yeah, you're a fool. You're trying to claim that the sages are a fool. You're a fool for taking their words like that, rather than seeing the depth of insight that they truly are. Agadot, they're not words of halacha, for they do not bring or expound upon actions that are required of us, which is the true purpose of Torah. She mentions many times, loa medrash ala hamaisa, to do, to act, to be. That's the true purpose. So what is agadot? It's the tool through which to recognize the creator of it all. For they open up the gates of understanding of heaven, which is otherwise sealed and locked. And one without the key will have no understanding. So that the sages try to convey to us an understanding of what we would call hashkafa, an outlook, an understanding of God, the purpose of life. These are similar to the ideas we spoke about last week in Kabbalah. And they're in the words of the sages. You just need a key to understand it. The analogy that I've heard used to describe this is when the sages talk in halacha, which is 90% of the Talmud, they want you to understand. The goal is that the reader and the student gets it. And anyone who's tried to understand the Gemara knows, even when they're trying to help us understand, it's pretty hard. Agadata, which are the secrets of the purpose of the world and the depth of understanding, they don't want you to understand. So they couched it in terms and phrases and stories and riddles that will maintain the nugget of wisdom without allowing it to be misunderstood, misconstrued, because it's hidden in something that you need to have the key to understand how to read it. So he who says, the sages don't know what they're talking about, is a fool. Because that's what it sounds like. But if you have the key to understanding it, so says the Maral, so that's the understanding, that's the Mesorah passed down from generation to generation. The Maral, the brilliance of the Maral is he's going to do two simultaneous things. He's going to live his life's work is going to be expounding on the words of the sages, as we're going to focus on tonight in a few moments. But he does so simultaneous because he believes that the words of the sages are revealing Kabbalistic concepts, which again, the Kabbalah which he spoke of hasn't even yet come out because he's living at the same time. But he's going to use Kabbalistic terms, ideas, but in layman's terms to explain the statements of the sages that are otherwise inexplicable, hard to grasp. So he's going to do two things. He's going to give us meaning and understanding to the words of the sages. And by doing so, he's going to reveal many of them through the Kabbalistic concepts that he's expressing really were at the core of what the sages were saying. Not everyone is a Kabbalistic concept, but we'll see threads of that idea in the way that he explains these ideas. I put in a letter F there on the top of page 2, so that what he did is he allowed these statements of the sages to be understood, and I put in parentheses, by some of the masses. And what I meant by that, as much as I'm describing he made him accessible, it is really hard to learn the Maral. He uses words, languages, concepts that are perplexing. The little that I understand is because I happen to have had a tremendous privilege in life. When I moved to Atlanta, I was invited to a chabura at one of the members of the community's households, Dr. Raf Gershon. There is a scholar today who lives in England. He's American-born. He spent many years in Israel. He's now in England, Rabbi Yeshua Hartman. Rabbi Yeshua Hartman was raised in St. Louis, if I remember correctly. He wrote, there are two prints of the Maral. This is the standard print of the Maral. It's all in Hebrew, no footnotes, no nothing. It's just page after page after page. It looks just like this. Maybe 12, 13, 14 volumes. And Rav Hartman has been working for years now on a newer version, which has, this is the Maral, and these are all his notes on the bottom. And he annotated it, and he put every cross-reference where the Maral speaks about this, or even where other scholars explain what the Maral meant, so that it becomes a lot more accessible. And I had the great privilege, while Rav Hartman was living in Israel at the time, we would have a chabura at Thursday night. We would go to Dr. Gershon's house at 11 o'clock at night, and it was 6 o'clock in the morning in Israel, and Rav Hartman would give us, we were maybe 6-7 guys around the table in Atlanta, and from Israel he would call in and give us a shiur on the Maharal. And I had a whole year of that, and that was, I was never really exposed to the Maharal before that, but that was a game changer that really gave us an expert, a real Talmud Chacham expert in Maral, and he was giving us a personal shiur on the Maral. I have all my notes from the classes that he gave, and that really just changed my entire trajectory towards Chumash and towards the Maral. So even as I'm trying to express how the Maral made Medrash accessible, that's with a Rebbe to help explain it, it's a little bit more accessible. There are many, many passages in the Maral that I don't know what he's talking about. And it's just, you know, looking for something else that I can understand. That's the way it goes with the Maharal. His major, major work is known as the Gur Aryeh. The Gur Aryeh is his commentary on Chumash. It's not a commentary on Chumash as much as it's a commentary on Rashi. He never makes a comment on the Gur Aryeh that's not based on a Rashi. So Rashi makes a comment, the Maral says, let me explain what Rashi, remember, Rashi almost always is quoting a Medrash. And the Midrashim, as we just quoted three of them a few moments ago, you could believe me, on every one of those three that I quoted you earlier, about the moon, and about the lion, and about the tree, the Maral has a lengthy discussion of, what does that mean? On every time you have a problem with Rashi, first place to turn, Maharal in his Gur Aryeh, what does he have to say? Moral wrote another sefer, he wrote many, we'll talk a few of them, called the Chidushe Agadata, Chidushe Agados, on all the Agadata, on all the passages in the Gemara that are not halachic in nature, but discuss these stories. Moral wrote a sefer on one by one going through each of them. Whenever a person has, now a student has a problem understanding a statement of a Medrash or a Gemara on Agadata type of topics, Moral is your first place to go. And just like Rashi, doesn't mean that everybody who came after him agrees with his comments, but that's where you start. He opened up the entire world of looking at this body of work, making it a system, and then working it through an understanding. And that's what I'd like to learn with you a little bit tonight, how he made it into a system. I'd like to take a look at three or four, maybe even we'll get to five different statements from the sages, and try to weave together, as he does, how he sees the themes running through. As we did with Rashi, I figure we might as well start with something that's related to the Parsha of the week. We just read this past Shabbos, the Aseres HaDibros, the Ten Commandments. I figure that's the most seminal moment that we have in Jewish history. So let's, Maimon Har Sinai, we're standing at Har Sinai. Let's take two statements from Chazal, two Midrashim, that Rashi quotes both of these, and let's spend our evening working through how the Maral works through these two statements on this episode of Kabbalah Satorah, Receiving of the Torah at Har Sinai. Yeah, so far so good? Let's do it. Source number one, bottom of page two. The pasuk which begins the Aseres HaDibros, everybody knows, what's the first pasuk? How does it begin, Aseres HaDibros? Anochi Hashem Elokeach, everybody knows. There's actually a pasuk before that. The pasuk before Anochi Hashem Elokeach is there in source number one, Vayidaber Elokim Eskol Hadvarim Ha'ele Lemor. And Hashem spoke all of these things, saying. And as I've highlighted to you, there's one word that's extraneous in that pasuk. The word all. If the pasuk just would have said, Vayidaber Elokim Es Hadvarim Ha'ele, and Hashem said these words, you would have known that it meant all of these words. So why does the Torah have to highlight that Hashem spoke all of these words? Rashi comments, that Hashem she'amar Kodesh Baruch Hu kol aseres hadibros b'dibur echad. That Hashem spoke all of these words tells us Hashem said all the words in one utterance. Now we have another example, by the way, of one utterance, which we say every Friday night. Shamor v'zachor. In the first of the Aseres HaDibros, Shamor, Zachor, they were said together, simultaneously. But did you know, it's a Rashi and Chumash, did you know that all of the Ten Commandments, all of them, were said in one moment, all of them were said immediately together. Which Rashi concludes and says, something that's impossible for a human being to do, and Rashi says something that's impossible for a human being to understand. We can barely understand when two people talk at the same time. Right? You can't hear two voices, which comes up, by the way, in halacha, which is why when laning, you can't have two people laning at the same time, because trei kali lo mishtami, two voices are not heard. You can't be yotze. Exception to that, of course, is Megillah. Because of the great love that we have for hearing the Megillah, you'll really concentrate. But in general, you can't hear two voices, which is also a leniency, which comes up in the halacha of Kolisha, where you can't hear a woman sing, but if they're two singing together, so the same principle, you can't really make out the voices. There are different leniencies because of that, which is not for tonight's topic. But all of them were said. All 10 were said together. Now, what's the problem with such a medrash? What's the problem with that? Did the people understand?
No.
So what happened afterwards? So then he had to go through Anochi Hashem Elokecha Lo Yeh Lecha Shamor. He had to go one at a time. So now ask me the obvious question. Okay, excellent. So if no one's going to understand, nobody could understand, what's the purpose in doing it? Now Rashi doesn't ask that question. Rashi just tells us the Medrash. The Medrash is picking up trouble by the word kol. And so Rashi says it's to teach you that they were all said b'dibur echad in one moment, in one utterance. And now we have a problem of, well, what's the purpose of that? Why did he do that? Well, guess who asks that question?
They're all unimportant. Together, you cannot.
Okay, good. You're giving an answer. So who asks this question? So the Maral asks this question. Now we're going to have he's going to give us two answers. Let me just, before I even get to this, the two Midrashim that I want to talk about, this is the one. The other one, we're going to get to the end, but it's much more familiar to you. The Medrash says, on the words of the pasuk that the Jewish people stood at the foot of the mountain. So the Medrash is really, the Gemara says, why does the Torah describe betachtit ahar at the foot of the mountain, which literally translates as under the mountain? You're familiar with this, right? That Hashem picked up the mountain and held it over their head and said, if you accept the Torah, everything's going to be great. And if not, I'll just drop this on your head and bury you. That's a more oft-quoted Medrash. Those are the two Medrashim let's talk about tonight. One of that the mountain was held over our head, and the second of the one that we just said, that all of them were said b'dibur echad. So let's see how the Maral learns these Midrashim. Yeah, are you with me? Okay. Says the Maral, I gave you the Hebrew just in case. All of the translations of the Maral, by the way, are mine. I could not find translations. So I did my best there. It's not literal word for word because I couldn't. I didn't know how to do it.
Did he write it in Hebrew?
What's that?
Did he write it in Hebrew?
He wrote it in Hebrew, yeah. Yeah, so this first one, you have the source in Hebrew on the bottom, in translation is on the top of page 3. The Maral is going to give us two answers. Why did Hashem say them all in one utterance if it's impossible for us to understand? Number one, says the Maral, even though they could not possibly understand that at all, nonetheless, he uttered them together to teach that the entire Torah is really all one. So that if someone were to say that all of Torah is divine, except for just one pasuk that Moshe said on his own, that person would be established as a kofer b'kol ha-Torah kula. He would be a denier of everything. If I teach you things one at a time, so then it implies that you could say that this is that I could divide it up, and I could say I accept this and I don't accept this, or I think maybe Moshe added this. But if they come all together, what's the lesson of Hashem saying it all together? To teach you, it really is all one. And it can't be subdivided. And if anyone therefore comes and says, I buy it all, 99.9% I buy it. This one idea, this one mitzvah, this one pasuk, Moshe made that up. That's not divine. Person who says that, 99.9 is zero. You're a kofer bako, you have nothing. And Hashem taught us that, says the Maral, by saying, what's the significance of b'dibur echad, of it all being in one utterance? It's indiscernible. It's all one. It's all together. And then he adds something a little bit more Kabbalistic. Let's learn it together. Furthermore, he says, this medrash reflects the elevated status of Torah. Hama'ala ha'gedolah. The great, status. I don't know how else to translate that. Of Torah. For it is well known and understood that the more something is distanced from the upper worlds and brought to the lower worlds, the more it becomes fragmented and separated. So we're going to have, let's work through these concepts. In the upper worlds, as you come down, and we're in the lowest of the lower worlds, as you come down to the world that we're in, the more you come down, the more the language is nitpared, the nitchalek, the more it becomes separated and fragmented. Because the upper world is called the world of unity. That world above is the Olam Ha'achdut. So that the more something is closer to Hashem, who is the ultimate unity of one, the more the object is unified as well. The lowly world we live in, which is distanced from Hashem, is a world of fragmentation and separation. Let's try to understand a little bit on whatever level we can. That's as an example. Take a flashlight. You flash a beam of light. So two things are going to happen as you flash that beam of light. You get a white light, and let's say I flash it right at the wall right here. How big is the circle that's right off of the flashlight? It's about the same size as my flashlight. As I pull my flashlight away, what happens to my light on the wall?
Bigger.
Correct. Everybody knows that. Basic science. Why does that happen?
Flatter.
Right? As soon as it gets out of the beam that it's being flashed out of, it expands as you go away. The farther away you get from the source, the wider your range of light is going to be. Let's take another thing and put them together. If I take that beam of light and I shine it through a prism, so instead if I have my prism here and I take my flashlight, what do I see on the wall? I'm going to see a bunch of different colors because as the light goes through the prism, It gets refracted into all the different wavelengths of the color. Now, over here, I'm going to see red, yellow, blue, green, all on the finger. But really, at its core, this was a white light that was just refracted through a prism. This is basic stuff. As an example, says the Maral, in the world of unity, in the upper world, that which is closest to Hashem, Hashem Himself, who is Echad, everything up there is Echad. The farther away you get, as you pull that light away from the wall, and you put worlds in between, the finite world, as we spoke about last week, the Kabbalistic concept of Tzimtzum, Hashem had to pull Himself back in order that there be space for a world to exist, and the black, the screen which allows His powerful light even to be shown in this world, so you need to refract that. By the time you perceive something in this world, you are so far from the source, it's been refracted and expanded. So that the world that we live in is a world of pirud and chiluk, a world of separation and fragmentation. But not because it is, but because we're so far from the source. At the source, it's echad. But there's a reality, as you get distance from the source of echad, these things happen. Yeah, a little bit. I'm trying my best to try as much as I can understand that. Says the Maral, where's Torah? Where's the source of Torah? The final paragraph back on the top of page 3. The Torah was given directly from the mouth of Hashem, and therefore nothing could be closer to oneness than the Torah itself. So the Torah which emanates from the mouth of Hashem is therefore one. Therefore it could only have been given from His mouth in one utterance, because the great status of Torah makes it befitting of oneness. That is why all the Ten Commandments were said together. This is the true explanation when you will understand it, for it is truth. When we perceive Torah, how do we perceive Torah? Many different commandments. How many different commandments? 613 commandments. Some are positive, some are prohibition. Some are for men, some are for women. Some are in the land, some are not in the land. Some for Kohanim, some for Levim. There are lots of different things. We can actually look at a single pasuk. As an entity, we can look at a single mitzvah. That should be impossible. How did you pull it away? How did you know to stop with this verse and that letter? It's all one. It's true. At its source it is, but by the time it gets down to this world, to human beings, remember the Medrash that the angels tried to stop Moshe from getting the Torah and said, keep it up here. And Hashem says, well, what do you answer to Moshe? Moshe says, did you come out of Mitzrayim? Do you have parents? Do you have to be honest in business? Okay, so we get it. The form of Torah that we have in this world, that's so far from it, it's already divided up into all the different refracts. We can have separate mitzvahs in a form that makes sense to human beings. But at its core, it's really one. And therefore, when Hashem gives us the Torah and says the Maral, from where? From His mouth. There's only one way to give it. And that is the Dibur Echad. Because how do I start with Anochi and not tell you Shabbos at the same time that I tell you about... It's all one. But in our world, we can't perceive that. So Hashem says, I have to give it to you as one. Okay, I know you're human beings. Nebuch. Okay, Anochi, Lo Yeh, and then Kibbut Avim. I'll go through them one at a time for you. But don't think that that's what it is. That's just the way that you can perceive or handle it, because you live in the world of pirud and chiluk. You live in a world of separation and division. So far, so good? I mean, on whatever level we understand, I know.
But his Hebrew is amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So I want to pick up on this idea that he says. Again, just follow where this is going. The pasuk says, kol hadvarim. Chazal, as Rashi quotes, says that means it's all the Dibur Echad. What's the meaning, significance of that if nobody understands it? Says the Maral, to teach you it's all one. You can't deny anything. And then he says, on a deeper level, it's to express a reality that when it comes from the mouth of Hashem, from the world, the upper worlds, it's the only way it can be. Yeah? Yes. I'm sure I can't answer whatever you're going to ask, I know.
The fact that after after the event, Am Yisrael says to Moshe Rabbeinu, you talk to Hashem, we can't take it. Can we see this as his light?
As being too much?
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. I think so. It's totally fair. Okay, let's continue this, but let's go to another topic. Uncle Lavan. So Yaakov runs from his brother Esav. Let's go back a couple parshas to Sefer Bereishis. He steals a bracha from Esav. His mother says, you got to get out of here. Esav wants to kill you. So his father sends him off to look for a wife. Yaakov shows up at the well, and who does he meet at the well on his way to his uncle? He meets his cousin, Rachel. And what does he do when he sees her? Kisses her, and then he... You remember? He cries. Excellent. Why does he cry? Rashi says two things. Number one, he saw right away they're not going to be buried together. Number two, he had no money. He had nothing to give her. Why did he have nothing to give her, Rashi tells us? Because Eliphaz, who was the son of Esav, ran after him and tried to kill him, and he took all of his stuff so that he was poor. And so Yaakov shows up empty-handed. He's got nothing. Okay, now let's pick up our story. Vayikishmoa Lavan, and then Rachel goes and tells her father Lavan, Yaakov just showed up. Your nephew Yaakov. Now Lavan's first thought is, well, wait a minute. I remember when Yaakov's father, Yitzchak, was being set up for a shidduch, and Eliezer, the servant, showed up. What did he show up with? 10 camels. Lots of gold and silver and gifts to give to the family. So Lavan runs, Vayoratz Likraso, Vayachabiklo, and he hugged him, and he kissed him, and he brought him to his house. And Yaakov tells Lavan all the things. Rashi comments. Some of you familiar with this, I'm sure. Rashi says, on hearing the, he ran towards him thinking that he was laden with money. For the servant of that household, Eliezer, came with 10 camels. He hugged him, he embraced him. Then he, well, when he gets there, Lavan, what does he see? Yaakov standing by the well, and who's he with?
Himself.
He's got nothing. Say he hugs him, says Rashi. And he thought, perhaps he brought gold coins and they're hidden away in his bosom. He's got them in his pocket. He kissed him. He thought, well, he didn't find anything in his pocket. So he said, I know. Maybe he's got pearls and diamonds hidden in his mouth. So he kissed him. And he finds nothing. And then Yaakov explains to him all that had happened. Okay, that now we did this in the Chumash class, those of you who were there earlier. This is a story that children are taught in school. All of my kids came home, they knew this medrash, based on Rashi. As adults, how does this sound?
Weird
at best, right? It sounds childish. That's what it sounds like. Lavan runs, and he's like giving him a pat down, and then he's searching in his mouth, he's giving him a kiss to see. That's what... So let's learn a morale. And again, the goal of the morale, I want to show you that the Chazal speak in depths beyond the words in front of us. Says the morale, in the box on the bottom of page 3, it appears that the sages mean to say that Yaakov hid his money. Let's do one word of background quickly. Let's use money as an example. We know we could use many examples, but that's an example in front of us. There are three different ways that a person, I'll use myself as an example, can deal with my monetary financial status. One is, I can let everybody know what I have. And I can do that through the clothing I wear, the house I live in, the car I drive, the jewelry that I... Anyone on the street sees me and says, that guy's got money. Now, that's what I want them to say. I can fool them. But if I want a person to know, I can let a person know. And it's out there for the taking. Another level is a person who lives in a way in which from the outside what you see is standard according to the community standards and norms. Wouldn't think anything. But their circle of friends know that they have money. So that it's not on the outside where anyone on the street can see. But within the circle of friends, everybody knows what's going on. Then there's a way to live that the circle of friends don't even know. Only those in the innermost circle or innermost family, only they really know what you have. Yes? Outside, anyone can see. Inner circle, and then my deep inner secrets that only my closest know. Says the Maharal, if you come with camels, what are you expressing? With and anyone, everybody walking by, I want everybody to see what I have. If I have something in my bosom, the cheko, in my pockets, what level am I at?
Second.
It's the second level. I don't want everybody to know. But it's hidden, but it's not hidden inside of me. It's just hidden on my body. If I put something in my mouth, now what I've done is it's not even on my body. It's inside of me. And that's only for special people. Camels, everybody can see. If it's in my pocket, so only my inner circle. How do you show me that you're in my inner circle? So if you give me a hug, you can display, you can show the affection that says, we're close. Tell me what you have. Not that Lavan is patting Yaakov down to see what he's got. He's giving him a hug to see, maybe I'm at the level of, that you'll tell me what you have on the outside, but hidden. And when Yaakov doesn't reveal anything, he gives him a kiss, which is a greater show of closeness to say, I'm so close, you can even tell me, Yaakov, tell me what you got. Even the things that are hidden within the depths of your soul that you don't want anybody to know, you can let me know, I'm your uncle, we're that close. And that the hug and the kiss are a sign of closeness and affection so that Yaakov will reveal not just a pat down and a search of his mouth. Chazal are expressing the levels of how and what we reveal to whom? Let's read his words quickly inside. It appears that the sages mean to say that Yaakov hid his money and they were in his bosom. Becheko, meaning an inner position where, unlike 10 camels, it cannot be seen by others. Lavan hugs him. He connected to his soul entirely. And then Yaakov would be drawn to him with love and would not keep the matter hidden from him. He would tell him what kind of wealth he has. And similarly, when the sages describe the love and said, maybe it's in his mouth, they're expressing the idea that the mouth is the innermost part of a person's body, more so than one's bosom, which is hidden from sight but not yet from within, but yet not within him. And through a kiss, one enters into the deepest, innermost place of the other person. And by doing so, Yaakov would reveal through their closeness where his money was. Now, go back to the first Chazal. When Hashem gives us the Torah, how does he say? Excuse me, he says it? B'dibur echad. What was the language the Maral used? I had it underlined in the third paragraph when Hashem gives us the Torah on the box at the top of the page. The Torah was given at the beginning of the third paragraph. The Torah was given directly from the mouth of Hashem. And therefore nothing could be closer to oneness than the Torah itself. Therefore it could only have been given from his mouth in one utterance. Follow the theme. When Yaakov... When Chazal wanted to express that maybe Yaakov kept something deep within himself and he wanted no one to know about it, how do Chazal express that? How did Lavan try to get it? To give him a kiss. Because if he can get into his mouth, that would express, I want your deepest, innermost secrets. And how does the Maral express when Hashem gives us the Torah comes? From his mouth. Not from his mind, not from his heart. He gave it to us from his mouth. Which is the expression. How does Shir HaShirim begin? Yishakenu minishikots piyu. Kiss me with the innermost kisses of your mouth. Give me your deepest, innermost wisdom. Says Chazal, says the Maral, Chazal are not playing games that Yaakov, Lavan is patting his chest and his arms and kissing his mouth. They're expressing what it means to have open wealth, hidden, and then inside of you. And Lavan couldn't find what Yaakov had. He wants to get inside of him. He gives him a kiss. Which is the same language he uses to describe Hashem giving us the Torah directly from his mouth. Let's borrow another part of this discussion going back to the original Maral. Section number 3. Moshe discovers the source of the Egyptian servitude. So as the Torah describes, that we read this a few weeks ago as well, Moshe grows up, he leaves the palace, and he sees an Egyptian beating up on a Jew, and he kills the Egyptian and buries him. The next day he goes out again, and he sees two Jews fighting, and he tries to break them up. And the Jew says to him, what, you're going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? Pasuk says... Moshe, I'm at the end of the pasuk in the bottom of page 3. Vayira Moshe, he was frightened. Vayomar, and he said, Achein noda hadavar. Indeed, the matter is now known. What did it mean when Moshe said, the matter is now known? Says Rashi. Two explanations. We're on the top of page 4. Says Rashi, Moshe was afraid. Explained in its literal sense, he was afraid of Paro. He was afraid that he was going to get into trouble. And the drashic explanation is, Rashi says, he felt distressed. Not afraid, but translating Vayira as he was distressed. Because he saw that there were wicked men amongst the Jews. Common informers and gossip mongers. He saw a problem. He did something on one day, and the next day, everybody knows. And he said, since this is so, perhaps they are not worthy to be delivered from bondage. Next Rashi, Achein nodah davar, now that surely the thing is known, explained in its literal sense, Rashi says, it's known that I killed the Egyptian. The Medrash says, what's known? It is now known to me, the matter which I have been puzzled, the Medrash says. Moshe was bothered. Tama ani, Rashi says. I was always troubled. What did the Jews do out of all the 70 nations to be subject to such a Holocaust? What'd they do? Babies thrown into the Nile, smashed against the rocks in the river. What'd they do? That they should be oppressed. But now I see that they deserve it. They're gossip mongers. Dalturim. And the Rashi. Now, our question on the Rashi and the Chazal. That explains it. They were a bunch of gossip mongers, and now that explains the servitude of Mitzrayim. What's the connection? Rashi says the language was they deserve it, and they're not going to be redeemed. Why? Where do we see that for being gossip mongers that all the Jews were speaking that Moshe killed the Egyptian? All of a sudden, they're not going to be redeemed. Do you have an answer to that?
I have a question which might be an answer. Was it from a certain point of view so logical that Moshe would kill the Egyptian?
No, for sure not.
Why wouldn't he take any blame for what he had done the previous day?
Well,
he's not taking blame. It could be. Let me focus. We don't have time. In other words, the issue that I want to focus on, it's a fair question, is we have a Medrash saying that the fact that the Jews were gossip mongers would prevent them from being redeemed. Enter the Maral to explain what's the connection.
Where did you get the gossip piece from? The
Deltur, because Achein Odah Davar, the matter is known. Achein Odah Davar. All this, everybody knows what I did yesterday. So it must be that people are talking. And if people are talking, they're never going to be redeemed.
But the gossip is the fact that they're gossiping right now.
Yes.
It's not only what he claims, Achein, but he hears the fact that those two people saw, probably more people saw. He looked around and he did not see a person. But they saw him. So if two people saw him,
So that's the first pshat in Rashi. The first pshat in Rashi is they saw, I see the matter is actually known. Second pshat is, the matter of their servitude is known on account of what? Do they deserve this? And do I have to be concerned they won't be redeemed? Because they're gossip mongers. Says, why should that be?
Connection.
Says in the box in the middle of page 4, this medrash is a wondrous explanation. For anyone who has the trait of being an informer and a gossiper is not relevant to redemption. Eino shayach. He's not relevant to geula. Again, we're going to see the theme of the words. For redemption extends from a lofty level that is sublimely internal, which is not revealed at all. Let's get that through again. The concept of redemption comes from a lofty level that is sublimely pnimi, internal, and not revealed. Again, go back to the Maral on had my wealth. I can either have my wealth revealed, a little bit hidden, or deeply hidden inside who I am. Where does redemption come from? From something that has to be deeply internal and not revealed. He who reveals things is the opposite of this trait. If you can't keep something inside, what does that say about you? Everything, they're like holes in your pnimi, and everything inside leaks out. To be able to hold something in means you have a strong and deep inner world. If you can't keep a secret, There's nothing internal inside and everything comes out. So someone who reveals things is the opposite of the trait of redemption, and he clings to the lowest levels, which is revealed in the external level. Therefore, Moshe understood what he saw when he saw that there are gossamongers among them who reveal secrets, that servitude was befitting them, because servitude is also the lowest revealed level. And this sin is most punishable regarding the Jews, who should occupy the highest secret innermost levels. When they fall from that lofty level, they sink to the very bottom. Which is another idea that Ralph speaks about, of that which should be on top. When you fall, you don't just fall one or two levels. Fall all the way to the bottom. This is what we saw in the times of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai sees the daughter of Nachdiman ben Gurion, one of the wealthiest people, picking through the dung to try to find some barley seeds. And he says, what happened to you? You were one of the wealthiest people. And on that, the Gemara says, when we fall the hardest. Because we should occupy the highest, innermost sanctuary. And when we don't, we end up at the bottom. But again, just for our purposes of for tonight, what theme is the Maral picking up from our original Medrash? We have Hashem living in or occupying the highest realm. From there, he gives us the Torah from his mouth. And if we're gossip mongers, what does that mean we have? No connection to the innermost place from which Torah and Hashem occupy, because that requires an inner world from his mouth that he's going to give Torah. And when we have no inner world, we have no expression of that Tzelem Elohim. We are the most external, revealed, and servitude is where we are. That is where the world that we occupy.
Is it related to humility?
Probably. I would imagine so, but I don't... I'm not sure. Let me keep going a little bit more. Just continuing this theme. One last thing on this theme. The Medrash says, Rashi says. Let's go back in a second. The Chumash says when Yaakov is on his deathbed, he says to Yosef, "Make sure you bury me in Mitzrayim. Bury me back in Canaan in the Maros HaMachpelah." And he says, and I know the way Rashi explains the Psukim, I know that you're thinking. Yaakov says, I didn't even do that to your mother. I buried Rachel right there on the road on the way into Beit Lechem, and now I'm asking you to take me all the way in. But Rashi says, quoting the Medrash, I did so because Hashem told me to do so, because when the Jews would be exiled from the land of Israel, we'll pass by her kever, and she'll come out, Rachel mevakal banel, she'll be crying for us, and we need those tears. The Maral expands upon that with the Medrash. That's on the bottom of page 4. The Medrash says that all the Avos are pleading with Hashem during the time of the destruction. Have mercy on your people. Look what's going on. The destruction was a terrible calamity. And finally, Mama Rachel stands up, the Medrash says, and says before Hashem, what have my children done to deserve this? Why are they being punished so? Is it because of the idolatrous practices they observed, which are similar to a mistress, like a tzara, a second wife? Are you, Hashem, taking it out on them because they brought in, so to speak, a mistress to their relationship with you? And they served other idols? Is that why they're deserving of this? Says Rachel to Hashem. Behold, Rachel says, I loved my husband more than anything. And he worked 7 years for me. Yet when my father switched me for my sister, this is a translation of the Medrash, under the chuppah, I relinquished my love of my husband and gave my sister all the signs. I'm just flesh and blood, says Rachel to Hashem, and you are a merciful king. How much more so you have to have mercy on your children. If I can have mercy on my sister and relinquish my husband who I love, and allowed a second wife into my marriage, then you have to have mercy on your children who brought in a second wife into your marriage. That is an interesting argument, Rachel says. I allowed a second wife in, so you should have mercy when we brought a second wife in by worshiping idols, which is the worst of them all. And Rachel is going to be Mevakal Banel. What's the meaning? Well, if you have a Medrash we don't understand, we turn to That was an obvious one. That's the class, right? Says the Maral. If you'll ask, why is Rachel crying more than any of the other, more than Sarah, more than Rivka? Why does only Rachel cry? Why does she only have the ability to make this argument? Listen to this, says the Maral. Rachel knew that Yaakov was destined to marry two wives. Because this world, a world of pirud and chiluk, of fragmentation and separation, is not fit to be one of complete unity. And if Yaakov indeed had only one wife, then the Jewish people would have been one. Yehuda would not have been from Leah and Ephraim from Rachel. We all would have shared one mother. And that will indeed be, in the times of Mashiach, will become one. But not yet. Because the world that was created, which is the world which allows Hashem's presence to exist, where we can exist and find Hashem, is a world of pirud and chiluk. It is not a world of unity. And now going back to that same thing, when Hashem gave us the Torah, even though we had to give it to us word by word, pasuk by pasuk, mitzvah by mitzvah, so that it looks like separate psukim and separate mitzvahs, really it's one. There's a ramification of living in a world that we have to take things one at a time. It's a world of disunity, of discord. It's a world of separation and fragmentation. And Rachel understood that world needed 12 children of Yaakov from different mothers. Rachel understood this, says the Maral, accepted it with love, even though it meant giving up the singular love of her husband. And therefore it was appropriate for her to ask Hashem forgiveness of the Jewish people for idolatry. Now listen to how he says this, because since there is no unity in this world, that's why there is idolatry in the world which caused the people to sin. You hear this concept? Says the Maral, you gave us a world of pirud and chiluk. You had to tell us that the Torah is really one, b'dibur echad. We couldn't understand dibur echad, because you didn't create us in a world of dibur echad. That's not who we are. You created us in a world that we can't handle dibur echad. You had to give us one at a time. I'll go back over it for you. That world can't handle one wife for Yaakov and unity right away. We have to get there. Remember we spoke last week, the Kabbalistic idea of why is the exile so long? And we spoke about a process to fix, to bring out all the Kabbalistic ideas. The Maral is introducing in these midrashim the idea of we live in a world of pogrom and inquisition and all the things of the Jewish people, crusades. It's a world of pirud and chiluk. It's not yet a world of unity. And he traces it back, and it really goes further. This is just an example for tonight. It goes back to Cain and Hevel, and Esav and Yaakov, and Yishmael and Yitzchak. It's a world of separation. And even Klal Yisrael needs to have four wives, two primary, the two maidservants, 12 children. And therefore it's Rachel who says, I gave up of the unification of my husband. I gave up on his singular marriage. His singular love. Because of the world you created, I gave up on that. That world is the cause of idolatry. How can you not forgive your children when they failed in a world that was set up to be one of 12 colors of the rainbow? We don't see the single light. That's not the world we live in. We see it distanced from the source. We don't see the Dibur Echad. We didn't even understand Dibur Echad. And therefore, Rachel claims you have to forgive them. Now, this is just an example tonight, and it took a little bit of time, how that one medrash of Dibur Echad, and he traces through some of the themes of the Dibur Echad, of the piv coming from his mouth, the idea of separation, the idea of discord, how that weaves its way through, and again, there's just a few of the examples, in his Sfarim, he'll spend pages and chapters taking these themes throughout everything. This is the Maharal. Taking a medrash, perplexing, sealed, closed, what does it mean? And then revealing in terms that a little bit we can understand what are Kabbalistic concepts to show the depths of what Chazal are saying. One last and we'll conclude. I gave you, we're not going to go through it tonight, his idea of thoughts on exile. He describes how the concept of exile is an unnatural thing when we're outside, and the force of nature will force back to its appropriate place. The force of nature will force us back to the land of Israel eventually, because you can't, and if you look at the bottom of his lines, you can't hold fire down. You can't have a solid matter and have it not fall to the ground. There are forces of nature. Exile is unnatural, and the forces of nature will bring people back to their natural homeland. That's you could take a look at that on your own time. Let's just do the last one. The Medrash, which I mentioned earlier, the oft-quoted Medrash that Hashem held the mountain over our head and forced it to accept the Torah. There's a major question that the Rishonim ask already on this Medrash. It's a Gemara, Masechta Shabbos. Hashem forced us to receive the Torah. And the question they ask is, somebody said it? Nasa v'nishma. Right? The Torah says that we accepted it willingly. So why are Chazal coming and painting a picture that we were forced into it? We wanted it. We said we wanted it. We said Nasa v'nishma. So why is it being held over our head? Many offer explanations. I want to share with you the Maral, which is a classic Maral. We really should spend an hour on this. We're going to do it in 3 minutes. The Maral says as follows. The primary explanation on the bottom of page 5. Is that the mountain was suspended over their heads to express that accepting the Torah was compulsory. This idea of a Dibur Echa, that it's all one, emanating from the place on high, from the mouth of Hashem, you can't not accept it. And that if they did not accept it, they wouldn't survive. And that's what the mountain, again, the Maral says, you don't have to read the Medrash literally, you just have to understand that the wisdom contained in it is divine. What's the meaning of a mountain over their head? You must accept this. It is a known matter, or it's known that matters which are compulsory are of the highest significance or stature. I don't know how to translate that. For it is impossible without them, and survival is impossible. So my example in the brackets. If I asked you, which is greater, air and water, or chocolate cake and ice cream? Which one is greater? Air, water on the one hand, chocolate cake and ice cream on the other. So I say, well, I ask the question, which one is greater? So if I ask which one tastes better, which one's more geschmack, so it's an obvious answer. But the reality is, we all know, as great as chocolate cake and ice cream is, we can live without it. None of us want to live without it, but we can. Life is better with chocolate cake and ice cream, but life doesn't exist without water and air. And therefore, in the scheme of things, which one is greater? By definition, that which you can't live without is greater. How does Hashem display to us that Torah is something you can't live without? So if you have a story of Rabbi Akiva and fish and water, great. Hashem says, I'm going to pick up this mountain over your head to express you don't have a choice. You can't live without this. Had we only said Nasa v'nishma, we would have walked away from Kabbalah Satorah, and we would have taught our children and our children to them. We would have said, we had this great offer, we took the offer. It's a great move by us. Really, I'm really glad we did. But you know something we would have said to our children? If we would have declined, we also would have been fine. We happened to have accepted it because we had the choice and we did. That's not true. There can never be a conversation in which a Jew says, we had a choice and we went with it. Good move, really good move. No, you didn't have a choice. You cannot live without it. Says the Maral, this is why we need more time to really fully express this. Something which you were forced into is not intrinsic to who you are. By definition, if you have to be forced into something, that means you don't want it. Not only do you not want it, but it's not a part of you. It's always external, evidenced by the fact that you have to be forced into taking it. Had we only had a mountain over our head, then Torah would never be a part of who we are. Because it always would have been something external to us that was forced. When you force a child to do something, as soon as the parent leaves, what does a child do? Whatever it wants. Because the only reason why he was behaving the way that he was behaving is because the parent was forcing it. That's not a great chinuch, because if it's your presence and fear, as soon as you go away, the child does what he wants. Says the Maral, this is the conflicting nature. On the one hand, Klal Yisrael had to say Nasa v'nishma. It had to be, we want it. This is what I want. And on the other hand, it can never just be I want it, because then I could always say, I don't want it. I can't ever say I don't want it. I have to have it. But I can't only have to have it. I have to also wanted. This is the tension that a Jew lives with. This really requires so much more time. I'm running through it. Every day of our lives, every moment of our lives is this tension of I have to, I want to. If I'm only living with an I have to, your children are not going to be very excited about it, nor will you. If I only live with an I want to, some events I really don't want to. Sometimes Shabbos, I'd rather not. And it's a tension of I have to, I want to. I want to, I have to. And that is expressed by the medrash of a mountain over our head that says, you must do this. Okay, that's just two of the two approaches to Kabbalah, Sator, some of the Midrashim, the Maral. Let me just quickly finish with the legends that have the Maral's influence is beyond from the entire Hasidic movement owes much of it, not all, much to the writings of the Maharal, Rav Shamshon, Rav Ol Hirsch in Germany, Rav Huttner, Rav Cook, Rav Dessler, the range of major Jewish thinkers until today that would say, yeah, it's because of the Maral. It just goes across the spectrum of the Jewish world of those who say, because he is the father of understanding Medrash. If there's a Medrash in Gemara and the Medrash, and you don't understand it, you turn to the Maral. You might not understand the Maral either, but that's the first place where you have to turn to in terms of understanding. When you have somebody so great, legends spring up about him. There's a legend that his very birth saved the pogrom. There was a sefer that prints the story, I can't verify it, that on the day that he was born, as his mother went into labor, somebody ran to grab a bunch of to find a midwife. And as they were running through the town, there was a non-Jew who was, this is the way the legend goes, was carrying a sack with a baby, a dead Christian baby in the sack, which he was planning on planting and then blaming the Jews with a blood libel. And as the people rushed out of the house of the Maral, he thought that he was caught, so he started running away. And some watch guard in the town saw a guy running with the sack, so ran over and tackled him and discovered what was going on. And so they attribute this, the being saved from the pogrom, to the birth of the Maharal. I'm just sharing the legend. There's another legend that I came across, that even the Christians have a legend that he was an old man, that the Malach HaMavis couldn't get him. And the only way that the angel of death was able to take the Maral is by disguising himself in a rose, and one of his granddaughters came and plucked the rose and gave it to him, and through that, they're legends which grow up around a person of such stature. The most famous, of course, is the golem of the Maral of Prague. And if you want to believe this particular legend, I invite you to step out for a moment, as I said earlier, because all historical evidence that we have indicates there is actually no such legend. I'm sorry. The Maral, of course, died in 1609. The very first reference of this legend of the golem of Prague, the first reference that we have is in the early 1800s, 1830s, 1840s. It's written up by a series of German literary authors, described this idea of a golem. 200 years go by, there's not a single reference, not in the biographies of the Maral. The Maral never speaks about it. It's not referenced anywhere. And then in the 1930s, it was reprinted by a Jew who actually lived here in Canada, who's a European Rav who moved to Canada. I have his name, Yudel Rosenbaum, and he writes, he wrote a book of stories, and he said it's a book of legends and stories, like made up tales, and he attributes that story of the golem to the Maharal of Prague. And even though this is one of the most widely spread stories, that the Maharal created a golem and he used it to protect from pogroms, which was clearly the issue of the time, and it was hidden in his attic, they renovated the attic in the 1880s, and nobody ever found anything in the attic in the 1880s. There is no reference anywhere in any writing until the 1800s, which is 200 years after the Maral's death, of such a story. You would think if there was such a thing as a golem, even in the non-Jewish literature, we'd find something. Zero. There's nothing about it. So Schneur Lyman, Dr. Schneur Lyman, is a historian, has a lengthy discussion of this, and actually traces where it came from, and proves pretty definitively that there's really no such story. But it's printed everywhere as if it's fact. You will find it. The reality is it's probably not fact. And it doesn't change a nothing on the greatness and the stature of the Maharal with a golem, without a golem, in terms of the impact that he had on the Jewish world. As I mentioned, on the non-Jewish world, the statue stands of him, and he is the first place on any Medrash statement from Chazal in Rashi in the Gemara. The Maharal is the source as far as understanding that, and I hope I did a little bit of justice to him and some of the approaches that he had in some of the Midrashim. I'll take some questions, but everyone's free to go. I went over an hour. If anyone wants to have a Maharal, we'll do so, and I'm happy to take a couple of questions. Yeah. Oh, the legend of the golem, for whatever it's worth, there was that the Maharal created out of clay a figure, and he wrote one of the names of Hashem on a piece of paper, and he put it into the forehead of the golem, and this figure turned to life and would protect the Jews of Prague from all sorts of pogroms and Christians and non-Jews. The legends vary whether or not the golem went crazy once and went on a murderous campaign. He used to take the piece of paper out on Erev Shabbos so that the golem would rest on Shabbos. There are various legends about the thing, about the whole episode. And historically speaking, the reality is it most likely never happened. But as Rabbi Wein, I'll conclude. Rabbi Beryl Wein says all the time. On story. Whenever he tells a story about a historical figure that he's giving a lecture on, so he says, I've heard this dozens and dozens of times, he says, here's a story they tell about so-and-so. He says, I can't tell you if it's true or not. I don't know if it's true. But I can tell you that they don't tell the same stories about Richard Nixon and the Chafetz Chaim. The stories you tell about a person are also reflective of the person. So here's the story. I don't know if it's true, but the Maharal is the kind of person that a legend about a golem arose, maintained itself, and everybody believes. Of course, the Maharal created a golem. Because you could believe such a thing about the Maharal. Did he actually do it? It doesn't seem so. Could he have? Very possibly. But he's the kind of person that such a legend would maintain itself very, very strongly, because that's who he was. All right, we'll see you all, Mirtz Hashem, next week. Have a great. If you want last week's class again, send me an email, and I'll try to arrange a time to do that.
Very interesting.